We are up against a very tough proposition, Manders, I began, and he nodded acquiescence. Up against the toughest thing you ever dreamt of in all the annals of crime. And I honestly believe that you are the only man in England, certainly the only man I can lay hands on, who can help me. Manders shrugged his shoulders slightly in deprecation. They are at the end of their tether at the yard, anyhow, he said, and at their wits' end how to carry the matter an inch further. I saw Blankensup only yesterday, and he admitted in confidence, which he won't mind my divulging to you, that it is a proper brick wall of a problem. Did he mention the German professor to you? I asked.
HBPodcraft.com.
That is a reading from part two of the Gerald Biss novel, The Door of the Unreal.
And you are joining us here for Werewolf History Month, or as I like to call it, February, at the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At HBPodcraft.com. I'm Chris Lackey.
And I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And our reader once again is Anthony Tedesco. He is troubled.
Yes, he is troubled. You know, Anthony, I've heard, can get you pregnant over the phone.
It's happened to two or three people.
Yeah.
At least one of them is a man.
Exactly. And that man is me.
What?
Yeah, that's the reason I know about this first. Can you imagine how hard it was to explain that to my parents? And to science? But that's the kind of voice he's got. And if you want to book Anthony for a voiceover job, just hit him up at anthonytedesco.net. We will link out to it in our show notes. So we're doing The Door of the Unreal, continuing on it this week. It's a 1919 werewolf novel that some would say is a Dracula knockoff.
It is.
It pretty much is. Lovecraft, however, liked it, thought it was a serviceable tale of werewolvery. And why don't we just go through what happened in part one?
Yeah, sure. Quick recap. Our guy Lincoln is telling this story. He's a well-off American fellow who's come to stay with his buddy Burgess in the UK.
Yeah. And Lincoln is clearly the Van Helsing of the story, I think.
Yeah.
He hasn't said it yet in part one, but he knows something else nobody knows.
Well, he seems to be in the know of the supernatural.
Yeah.
Pretty early on. Near Burgess's estate, there have been two incidents of people driving from London to Brighton and disappearing. First, it was a newlywed couple, then an earl and his actor girlfriend. The case was sensational. Eventually, Burgess's sister, Anne, found the body of one of the missing guys, this guy, Tony, unconscious in the woods.
Yeah, he was the earl. And I'd say Tony is kind of the Jonathan Harker of the book. And, you know, his missing girlfriend, the actress Waffles, she would sort of be the Lucy, the one that was sacrificed to the monster in order to get the plot going.
Now, Tony is being kept on their estate. Well, not against his will. He's in a coma. And they're nursing him to health. He was found near Dower House. Now, Dower House is part of Climping Manor, mm-hmm. which is the estate that Burgess owns and lives on. Dower House is the old house that the family used to live at, you know, hundreds of years ago. But now there's this guy that's living there, and his name is Professor Wolf.
Right.
And he lives there with his daughter, Dorothy, and her ex-nanny, Anna.
And the house is the adjacent property that the intruding foreigner has rented. Again, just like Dracula, he sets up office next door to our heroes.
After meeting with Professor Wolf, Lincoln has an idea. Maybe this guy might be the problem or connected to the problem some way. We don't know, because the way it's going on in the story is that he's withholding the information from the reader. He goes to this guy, Manders, his lawyer friend of his in London, and he talks with him, and that was the exchange we heard at the top.
Right, and Manders has already been involved in this drama. He was one of the first on the scene when Tony and Waffles disappeared.
Yeah.
And then we find out that Lincoln, who showed up later, also knows him, and that they banged around Romania together for a couple of weeks earlier. And that gets us, that's part one. So in chapter one of part two, Lincoln takes off for London. As we said, he won't tell anybody, including his best friend Burgess, what his suspicions are. And it's a little frustrating for the reader to have him delay it when we know what he knows, basically.
Yeah. It's so flippin' obvious.
Yeah. But, you know, Biss says that he likes to write these really realistic stories, which is why he built the credibility through the documents in the first part. If you really, in the real world, were dealing with this, it probably would be better to gather evidence before just throwing out some werewolf accusations.
Sure.
Although, I think if anybody did really identify a werewolf, it would be shocking for a couple of days. But then I think people would adapt pretty quickly.
Well, people adapt to things very quickly in general.
Yeah.
But I don't know if a couple of days is really going to be like that. I mean, that would, you know, raise so many questions so that somebody could change into another creature in a matter of minutes.
What do you think the news cycle on that is? 2 weeks?
Yeah, sure. So Lincoln goes to London and talks to Manders, who we talked about before. Manders is on board right away. Again, we don't know what he says to Manders. Mm-hmm. We just know that he tells him his theory. Manders takes off right away to go to Europe and do some research on Wolf, find out where he's been, what he's done, and if the suspicions are true.
Yeah, and whatever it is, Lincoln hints that he and Manders had discussed this issue at considerable length one night in Romania. You know, so you can hand wave the convincing. Manders, obviously, he and Lincoln have talked about this before. This part really made me laugh. It's extraordinarily convenient to begin with that Manders is just about to go on vacation, so he can go run around Eastern Europe and do research on this professor on Lincoln's dime. But also, you know, he's married. Lincoln's maybe a little concerned about, well, what are you going to tell your wife? And he says, oh, my wife, she's all right. A real good sort who will understand without being told too much when she gets a hint that it is of vital importance. So he's not going to tell her what he's doing. Can you imagine? Right. He just goes, remember that vacation that we had planned, honey? Like I was going to be around the house and stuff. No, I'm going to leave and go somewhere and I'm not telling you where or what about. And then she's just okay with it. I think the subtext is pretty clear. That Mander's wife is cheating.
Oh, she's cheating on him.
Yeah, she's like, oh, no problem, honey. Go ahead. I don't even know what you're doing. That's totally cool. Soon as he's out of the house, she's ringing up the milkman.
That's that gets us into chapter two. First thing he's doing, he's getting some guns.
It's that whole role-playing game vibe again, you know?
It is.
Let's get that stuff ready.
He gets a packer ready to send to Major Blenkinsop at Scotland Yard if he's arrested. Or worse.
Another one of my favorite lines is in this section. On his way back to the train, he stops to get Anne some presents while he's in the city, and he gets her one of those handbags with all sorts of unnecessary bottles that women like to bother themselves with. How does he know they're unnecessary? He doesn't know what...
It's just kind of the misogynistic.
Yeah.
At the time, I mean, women couldn't vote.
I know.
For crying out loud. Pretty ridiculous to even think that was the way things were, but of course it was.
Yeah. I would say that there's always that kind of misogyny present in a lot of books of this era, but this being a takeoff of Dracula, it's really amusing to me because in Dracula, the women were actually quite independently willed and smart and mean as the linchpin of the whole thing. And here they're just, they're silly little goofs with unnecessary bottles, you know?
So he goes back to the estate, lets Burgess know that things went well with his talk, but he still won't tell him anything. They have a little bit of a fight because Burgess is like, man, why won't you flip and tell me?
Yeah.
And he goes, look, you gotta trust me on this. There's a reason why I'm not telling you. You just have to wait. And when the time is right, I will tell you. And he's like, okay, you're my friend. You've always been a good friend to me. I'll trust you.
Yeah. They have 90 of those conversations in this book.
Yeah.
Goes on and on. Chapter three, Dorothy Wolfe shows up at Climping Manor. She's having tea with Anne.
Yeah, some more flirting with Anne, Lincoln is. But he's studying Dorothy. He's trying to gauge her. Not sure what to make of it at this point. He seems to be pretty attracted to her himself.
He does, yeah. She's got this really direct manner that he appreciates. Of course, she's still wearing that fur cap.
Yeah.
There's a weird thing. Continuing with the Dracula theme, one would think that Anne is the Mina of this book, but she doesn't do very much other than nursing.
Yeah, no, Dorothy is totally the Mina of this.
Yeah, well, I think they kind of are combined. I think there's a lot of splitting of characters that Biss has done here, where Anne and Dorothy are the Mina, and Lincoln and Manders are the Van Helsing together. Mm-hmm. Tony in his bed is Jonathan Harker, but so is Burgess.
Right.
It's interesting to me.
So he asks her about Professor Wolf and what he's up to, and he says that he's going to come by for a visit because at one point when he met the professor said, oh yeah, come by for a visit, even though he didn't really mean it. And Dorothy says, oh yeah, make sure you don't plan it because he'll keep pushing it off. Just show up.
He obviously dominates her. He's a little cruel. He's got this instincts of a recluse to flake on people. She keeps saying, you know, it's tough to live with a genius because he's so smart about his bugs and his plants. That excuses all of his behavior and eccentricities, you know. It's great. I mean, I keep trying this at home, but it just doesn't work.
Right. I think you have to be a genius.
Well, hey, come on. Yeah, I know. Unfortunately, it's kind of like getting nicknames. You know, you can't pick one for yourself. Somebody's got to give it to you. I keep telling my wife, I'm like, look, I peed all over the toilet seat, but I'm a genius. She doesn't buy it.
None of us do. Another thing that he says is he asks her about marriage. Lincoln does.
Yeah.
Kind of maybe feeling her out. I think he's feeling her out for Burgess because he thinks Burgess should get married and he knows Burgess is kind of interested in her. But then there's stuff that he says that makes you think, well, maybe he's kind of interested in her.
It's definitely hard to figure out what's going on with them, which I guess is intentional.
Yeah.
Chapter four.
He writes and eats and smokes.
That's right.
Chapter five. Tony is doing better and out of a coma, but still very weak.
And he doesn't remember being in the delirium when he, if you remember when he was saying, big dog, green eyes, jumped over moon, when he said it just like that.
No, he didn't say it like that. He said, big
dog. No, it was real monotone, like big dog.
Green eyes, jumped over the moon. You know, like all sweaty and shaking his head back and forth when he does it. Tony's uncle has come to stay and check in on him while he recovers. Lincoln really notices Anne is paying a lot of attention to Tony, really taking care of him.
That was my first inkling that maybe it wasn't going to happen with Lincoln and Anne.
Yeah, me too. I was like, oh, she's into him, isn't
she? Yeah, because it's that she rescued him. It's that classic romantic notion.
Florence Nightingale.
Yeah, yeah.
So Lincoln tries to spend a little bit more time with Dorothy. He's really interested in her, is trying to understand what's up with her. We don't know what he's trying to figure out about her because he hasn't revealed that stuff yet, but we'll find out later. And he also begins to like her more and more the time he spends with her, and really appreciates like that she's a really cool person and that she's very attractive and all this stuff. But he also knows Burgess really likes her. We get the inkling that this is why he's keeping Burgess in the dark, is somehow she's involved with this. And he does it.
Yeah, whatever his theory is.
And there's more flirting with Anne.
Of course.
Chapter 6, Anne and Lincoln go into town, her to shop and him to do some secret work. More Anne flirting, to the point that he says he would marry her, but he knows that he would make her miserable.
The important part of this chapter, the clue in it, is that on their errands, she swings by the butcher shop. He waits outside, he's having a cigarette, and he sees the butcher's assistant out there cutting out a huge chunk of beef topside. He says, wow, that's a pretty big chunk of meat. Must be for a huge family. And the assistant says, no, this is all for Professor Wolf. He likes to eat a lot of meat, and people say he eats it raw.
Dun, dun, dun.
Exactly.
Chapter 7. Anne, Burgess, Lincoln, and Whiskers.
The dog.
Go down for a walk by the Dower House to visit.
The whole atmosphere was one of dampness among the trees. And there were one or two big pools to the side of the track as we drew near to the little slipgate into the woods. And I noticed Whiskers, who trotted up and sniffed one, shake his head and run off, whining as though frightened. I purposely made no remark, but went across as though casually and examined it. The water had a strange, unpleasant appearance, turgid, with a strange lurid sparkle of its own out of keeping with the shadow around, as though the water itself held some strange individual life within it. And it had a peculiar, though not very strong, odor, which was quite distinctive.
I thought the water was... That was something that jumped out at me as being different from other werewolf stories that I've read. Some kind of werewolf water, right?
Yeah.
I know when we looked at different ways that you could become a werewolf, one way that is in the myth, if you drink water out of a werewolf's footprint.
Oh, right. I totally forgot about that.
That it could turn you into a werewolf. But this isn't that. These are just like naturally occurring pools, or maybe they're even constructed.
There's a lot of strange stuff about how one becomes a werewolf, and they don't really go into specifics of it. They just kind of hint at life.
Well, in the end of the book, he credits Elliot O'Donnell's Werewolves, which was a book written in 1912. I would bet that you would find almost everything that Lincoln talks about in that book.
It makes me really want to find that book.
Yeah, I got to find that one. And it probably expands more on this water and the flowers as well that we're about to come across.
Now, in Chapter 8, they get to the house. Dorothy's out there gardening, but actually waiting for them. Lincoln gives her a box of chocolates.
She's not that into the chocolates. She says, I used to love these, but I'm not so much into sweet things anymore. And he is shocked.
A woman that doesn't like chocolate?
Because a woman not liking chocolate means something supernatural is afoot. That is more proof.
So Lincoln notices a horrible smell that's coming from the strange flower that Dorothy's wearing.
Yeah, it's a weird orange flower with hideous black protruding spots, obviously not native to England. Now, lycanthropous flowers, I've heard of that as well before, like flowers that make you a werewolf if you wear them during a certain phase of the moon or something like that. Yeah. Anne also notices at that point that there's a big hole in the hedges, like a cow barreled through, some large animal made this space. And so Anne and Burgess, they go check it out to see what the deal is with that.
They go off there. Lincoln says to Dorothy, interesting flower. And she says, oh, yeah, my father grows them. You want to come take a look at where he grows them? And he said, yeah, sure. Let's go take a look at them. There's a ton of these flowers. And there are more of these puddles of water around.
If some of the flowers are red and vivid white, but they're all growing around these puddles.
So Lincoln asks her to see her flower. And she just, you know, gives it to him. He looks at it. He takes it. And he throws it on the ground and stamps on it. And then he apologizes to her and says, would you please not tell your father that I did that?
It's a creepy scene in a way, you know?
Yeah.
Because he gets so mad and just stashes it out. And then, you know, don't tell your dad that I just did this thing. It's almost like molesty, you know? It's really
weird. Yeah, it's a little creepy. Yeah. It is. And not in the way it's supposed to be creepy. They go back to the others, talk about the big animal hole some more.
And then they end with some more marriage jokes about Lincoln and Anne. That's another thing. It just goes on forever.
Chapter 9, they go into the house. It's creepy. Anne is there. She gives them a creepy look. And then she leaves, goes into a room, locks the door behind her.
There's the description. It says she's not only bizarre, so utterly out of the picture, but there's something about her that gives a goose-flesh feeling. There was an aura of evil, of repulsion around her, to those sensitive to such intangible influences, as I have always been since I can first remember. Lincoln is a little kind of psychic, too. I think he fits the Lovecraftian protagonist mold very well.
Well, there's that fine line, you know, like mm-hmm. Lovecraft also had those, the artists that were sensitive. They were just in touch with the world in ways that regular people weren't.
And even in The Tomb, which we talked about last time, it predates this story. But again, in that he says the store of the unreal is only available to a psychologically sensitive few. Right. It's the same idea that he plays with.
Some common elements here, and I can see why Lovecraft liked this story.
Yeah.
Anyway, they get inside the house. It's nice. But creepy.
Yeah, it feels almost like a tomb or something. You know, there's this kind of dankness and evilness about it. But Dorothy, she occupies the drawing room. She's got a nice fire in there. She's dressed it up. She says, "I love light and fires and lots of lovely things everywhere. I often feel I was made for them, though I have so little chance of having them so far."
Oh.
And then there's a one-line paragraph that says, "It was unconsciously pathetic." And I thought that was the best writing in the book.
Yeah.
It really made me feel bad for Dorothy. But there's a nice fire going and they hang out in the drawing room, which gets us into chapter 10.
As they're talking, the professor comes in. Lincoln is like, "You told me to stop by, so here I am." And the professor's kind of like, "Huh, okay, sure. All right, let's go in the library and we'll talk." Now, he says Wolf is repellent. There's just something about him that's unnatural and creepy and weird. But the guy's really clever and a really good conversationalist.
They have a good chat. While they're talking, Wolf, he kind of lays down on the sofa and curls his legs up under him like a dog. It's funny.
We need more hints at this point. I'm not sure. Wait. He curls his legs up like a dog?
Oh, my God.
I think I figured this one out.
Eureka.
But they have a conversation for a while. They leave, join the others. They all have lunch. Of course, strange thing, the raw meat sandwiches that they have.
Yeah, and the professor grabs into him. He's just popping one after the other into his mouth. It's really disgusting.
"I do not know whether you dainty English will care for my special sandwiches," he remarked truculently. "I have made them of raw meat. Some of our leading professors in Germany advocate them, and they are given to invalids as they are so strengthening and so easily..." He paused for an instant for the word, munching the while. "What you call assimilated. I find my brain works much better on them. Once you folk got over your silly ideas and prejudices, you would find that they are delicious. Much better than your dry, tough, scorched meat. I am teaching Dorothea to eat them."
Has he ever heard of trichinosis?
Yeah, it's pretty disgusting.
Dorothy also says that she's starting to like them as well.
Mm-hmm.
And Wolf asks her, you know, it's like, okay, now we kind of know where this is going.
Yeah.
Wolf asks her where her flower is, and she says, "Oh, I must have lost it." So she covers for Lincoln.
Right.
The professor always calls Dorothy Dorothea, which is the German form of the name. Her mother called her Dorothy, and she likes that better. Now, we find out that her mother is dead, and she died when she was 10 years old.
Right.
And then those guys leave.
In the next chapter, they get a little bit of news.
Sheep have been killed and mutilated at a nearby farm. Looks like it was done by some big dogs. Not much was actually eaten, mostly just killed, mutilated. Mutton thinks that someone sicked some dogs on the sheep.
Yeah.
You know, like kind of just out of maliciousness.
A very typical horror movie cutaway. There's missing children and sheep are being mutilated. We know what we're dealing with. Chapter 12, not much happens.
No, Thursday and Friday pass with no events. Tony's health improves and is ready to talk. Lincoln asks if he could be the first to question him, and Burgess says, "Yeah, okay."
Right.
Of course, Tony doesn't remember anything about the accident.
And he's mentioned nothing about Waffles disappearing, so it's really a non-chapter.
Chapter 13, Lincoln gets word from Manders. It's a telegram. It says, "No doubt about John. Back Thursday. Meet me midday temple. Manders."
Mm-hmm.
Now, he said they wanted to talk in code in case something was amiss. Like, I don't know how Wolf would have found out about this, but they didn't want anybody knowing that they were looking into Wolf. So they said, "If you find out anything about Wolf, call him John. It's about Wolf. Yes, everything you suspected is true. I'm going to meet you back." So just got real.
I hope so. I hope the punctuation's right in that telegram, because it could be "no doubt about John." Another thing that's going on is Dorothy's lips are getting redder. Her eyes are contracting and lengthening toward the ends of the lids.
Weird.
So some kind of transformation is being wrought about her. Very urgent. In chapter 14, Lincoln goes up to London to meet with Manders, right?
Their plan is to take all their evidence and go to Scotland Yard. When Manders gets back, he fills in Lincoln. The professor lived all over Europe, Berlin, Vienna, but he got run out of Romania near the Harz Mountains.
Yeah. And in those circumstances all over Europe, he was traveling under a number of aliases. There was Dr. I'm a Werewolf, Professor Wolfgang von Chaney. Nobody knew. In Austria, apparently he was working as a drag queen known as Cherwolf.
What?
He would perform the songs of Cher, but as a wolf. Nobody knew he was a werewolf. Or maybe those names are too obvious, which is why he settled on like Curtis Wolf here in England. But, you know, his departure is wrapped in mystery. When he got away from Transylvania,
yes,
some superstitious peasants had ran him out of there, which, as you mentioned. But I was like, couldn't Biss have come up with a better location than Transylvania?
Yeah. That's where all supernatural things come from. Transylvania.
Manders has put all of his stuff together in a document. So Lincoln has his document recounting everything that he's learned. Manders has his. In this chapter, they just read each other's documents back and forth a bunch. They eat some lunch, that kind of thing.
Yeah, they eat a lot. Almost every chapter, there's mention of eating.
Of course.
Somebody eats something. One of the things that they point out is they think that things are really going to get real soon because mm-hmm. next Tuesday night, is not just a full moon. It's also Walpurgis night.
Yeah.
So double trouble, full moon and Walpurgis night.
Yeah, that's bad.
So they go to Blenkinsop's and then they just lay it out for him.
Yeah, they're going
to
tell the cops about everything that they know.
So this is the chapter where we get the full lowdown, and not just the cops, but the readers as well.
Yeah, and we're halfway through the book at this point. Maybe even more than halfway through the book when he finally kicks in with, have you ever studied the subject of lycanthropy? And then Professor Lycurgus Wolf and his old servant, Anna Brunolf, are werewolves. The word finally comes out.
Yeah.
And they are responsible for the disappearances on the Brighton Road. So finally, we're being absolutely direct about this.
He goes into a bit of werewolf history talking about the legends. And we talked about a bunch of these already on the show, so there's no point in going over them, except for one, which I never heard of, that St. Patrick, mm-hmm. the St. Patrick of St. Patrick's Day, made werewolves.
Yeah, I'd never heard of that either. He pulls a ton of stuff probably from that werewolves book.
I did a little bit of research on this. Supposedly, St. Patrick punished the Welsh King Vereticus by transforming him into a wolf because he was trying to convert him to Christianity. He was a pagan. He was disgusted with certain tribes, St. Patrick was, because they wouldn't convert. Vereticus was the head of one of these tribes, so he turned him into a wolf. Now, it's weird, too, because it wasn't just him. It was all of his people mm-hmm. would turn into wolves, but not overnight. They would turn into wolves for 7 years, and then they would stay as wolves for 7 years, and then once that time passes, they would turn back to humans, but only for 7 years.
Crazy.
And then they would go back to be wolves again for 7 years until they died.
That would be hard to keep a job.
But during the 7 years, the wolves weren't denied the sacraments of the church. 1191, a man named Cambrensis recorded the testimony of a priest who swore that he gave sacraments to one of these werewolves. So it's documented. This isn't myth. Yeah. This is true. This happened.
If it's if somebody wrote it down, sure.
If somebody wrote it, happened, yeah. Man. You know, Irish werewolves are a big deal, mm-hmm. which I didn't realize that was a thing. So up until the 18th century, Ireland was also known as Wolfland.
Really?
Because this was like a big deal, which I never heard of before.
Wolfland is actually a better name.
Than Ireland? Yeah, no.
Well, it's because wolves, you can also think of them as being kind and beautiful and natural, whereas Ireland... Ire is just anger. You know? That's pretty crazy.
But I guess this wasn't just St. Patrick's that would turn unbelievers into werewolves. I guess this was like a common thing that happened all over the world for people that didn't convert to Christianity. So who knows? Maybe St. Patrick did turn pagans into werewolves for not bringing Christ into their hearts.
I'm sure it happened.
Yeah.
Just like in when Lincoln's telling his whole story, he goes, and surely you've all heard of Little Red Riding Hood, as if that's some piece of evidence as well.
How is that evidence?
I don't know. But he says he's had actual werewolves pointed out to him, whole families. There's also this legend of the dog Gellert mm-hmm. that he says, isn't that a werewolf myth? Have we ever talked about that before?
I don't think we have.
Because I wasn't familiar with it, and it's not really a werewolf legend. It's sort of an ancient urban legend that's also Welsh. Mm-hmm. Gellert was a dog that was supposed to belong to Llewellyn the Great, who is the Prince of Gwynedd, which is like Northwest Wales. And this dog was a gift from the king. And in the legend, Llewellyn, he comes home after hunting and he finds his baby missing and the cradle's overturned. And the dog has blood smeared all over his mouth. So he thinks the dog got in and
right.
killed his child. So he draws a sword and he immediately kills his dog. After the dog dies, after his last dying yelp, Llewellyn hears his baby. And he goes over to the cradle and lifts it, and the baby is under the cradle, unharmed, and there's a dead wolf, which had been attacking the child. The dog killed the wolf, Llewellyn is overcome with remorse. He buries the dog, but he can still hear that dying yelp in his ears. And after that day, Llewellyn never smiles again. What a terrible...
That's a total urban myth story.
It's a total urban myth, isn't it? It's got that same structure.
Yeah.
Well, that comes up. And so a couple of new werewolf fun facts that we didn't have before.
Yeah.
Popped up in that chapter.
Chapter 16, he lays out the facts of the case, the obvious facts.
Right.
Big dog jumped over the moon, green eyes, the full moon, meeting the professor... How the professor destroyed the evidence. Remember when Tony was attacked, there was like some kind of wound on his shoulder. The professor cut off the clothing to hide the raw meat, the flowers, all the stuff.
Right. And the professor, of course, totally looks like a werewolf. The teeth, the ears, the fingers. Lincoln thinks that his plan is to start a cult of lycanthropy in the very heart of England. And he says, if this takes hold, it cannot be eradicated. We have to nip it in the bud, which really to me, I mean, we've been talking about the World War I parallels. I think that sounds a bit like a reaction to the Bolshevik Revolution. You know, we can't have those communists get a foothold in this country, because if they do, we'll be unable to stop the spread of it.
Wait, wasn't that the same in Dracula, though? Weren't they afraid that Dracula was going to start a vampire cult?
Yes, they were. Absolutely. So there's both things going on.
I think you're giving it more credit than it deserves, really.
Maybe I am. Well, there's also a little more color on the incidents of the escape from a couple of years before when Wolf and his servant Anna escaped from Romania. Apparently, there were some missing children.
Oh,
it's curious that there's no mention of Dorothy in any of their accounts of traveling across Eastern Europe, however.
Yeah, he admits that he also suspects Dorothy is involved, but she's not yet a werewolf, but she's being turned into a werewolf. And then that's what's going to happen on Valpurgisnacht. The culmination of all of his work and all the magic that he's doing with the flowers and the water and all that stuff.
It said Walpurgisnacht so many times that I started thinking of a good reality show. You know how like Mark Wahlberg's family has a Wahlburgers show, like they own a restaurant?
I did not know that.
They have a reality show about that, but I'm thinking whenever that gets canceled, Walpurgisnacht. And it's Mark Wahlberg, Donnie Wahlberg, they all turn into werewolves.
What? That's not a reality show.
Isn't it?
Chapter 17. This is where he lays out his actual plan.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to get a bunch of guys to hang outside the house on Walpurgisnacht.
Mm-hmm.
And here it is. This is it. They'll hide and wait. And if they see any wolves, they shoot them.
That's right.
That's the plan. Which actually seems pretty solid to me.
It's super solid, man.
Yeah. If they're wrong, then no wolves will show up. There won't be any wolves. Nothing to shoot. But if they're right, Lenny... You'll be saving the lives of millions of registered voters. No. If they're right, then there'll be wolves. And then they can shoot the wolves. And then they know that they're not actually people.
You citing Ghostbusters there, though, is a great example. Because the Ghostbusters do what these guys, they go and they get the police on board.
Yeah.
And then they make a plan. It's like there's no rules that they introduce. Like if you kill the head werewolf, then this will happen. And we have to read from this book. They're just like, A, make sure they're werewolves. B, shoot the motherfuckers. It's a two-step plan. I love it.
And chapter 18, the last chapter of the second part of the book. The next day, they go back to Scotland Yard. They sit down. Cops say, okay, we're in. But if a normal person dies, Lincoln and Manders are on the hook for the murder.
I will take all responsibility, I said, and stand or fall by what happens. And I too, again said Manders with sharp decision. Then I will send down a high confidential official with special instructions and full powers to act, said the chief. As a safeguard to both yourselves and ourselves. Then Blenkinsop spoke. With your permission, sir, I will go myself. The chief nodded, and so it was arranged, to my intense relief and satisfaction as time was growing perilously short.
Cops are on board. They love it.
Cops are on board. The plan is set. And in part three, we're going to see that plan in action.
This is one of these stories that, when I read it, I flew through it. I loved it. But the more that... the more that I'm spending time in doing the notes, the more I realize how kind of stupid this story is.
Of course. It just falls apart.
That's kind of the opposite, actually, of what goes on in the show. Usually, I'll read a story and not like it very much, but when I sit down and start doing the notes, I really appreciate it. I find things and then I go, wow, that's really cool. Or, oh, I never really looked at it that way. But this is the exact opposite. It's just horrible. But, I mean, I still enjoyed reading it. So.
No, it's most of the stories we have to unpack. And in this one, when you unpack, there's nothing in there.
It's a really nice suitcase.
Exactly. It's the display model.
Oh, my gosh. Well, next week, this will be our last story of Werewolf History Month. We'll be finishing up this story. Again, we'll have Anthony Tedesco, who did a great job again this week.
Yes. Thank you, Anthony.
I said that he was a filthy man last week. I stand by that. Yes. However, I want to say that I adore him. He's amazing.
He can inseminate you over the phone. When the phone rings and you pick it up, you just hear, 9 months. And that's all we got for you this week. We'll be back with more werewolves. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast
at hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.